What's that, a southern welcome? Yeah. My name's Paul, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic. Can you all hear me? Well, we've got the speaker system going right, but I'm a little concerned yet about the chairs. I think we ought to run through that routine one more time. There goes one now. Yeah. I'm going to have trouble facing the mic and keep my eye on mine back there. Okay. I was sitting there feeling kind of bad about the people who have to stand. And then I thought, well, what the hell, I have to stand. Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. Glad to be here till the fire marshal gets here. And then it's every man for himself. I want to congratulate the New Hope Group on their anniversary. Hope they're Sounds like a half dozen of them are here. I hope their anniversary celebrations don't grow anymore. I want to congratulate all the CHIP people and birthday people. I want to wish a four-day post-dated happy birthday to Tony and Lonnie, who will be 19 and 10 years birthdays in 4 days, and going to get married this month, too. And drove down from South Carolina. Let's give them a warm welcome. That's enough. They might go to their head if you give them too much. I'm glad to be here. Now, where I come from, we always have a show of hands. It's been my experience that you find a lot of alcoholics at AA meetings. Can we see the hands of all the alcoholics? Can you please raise your hand? See? Yeah. We've got a quorum right off. Go right ahead with the meeting. And we've got some Al-Anons here, too. I know. Yeah, there's at least a dozen of them. I knew they were here, but I can feel the vibrations. Let's have a show of the hands, the Al-Anons. Don't be ashamed now. Put your hands up. Oh, see, there's a lot of them. Give them a hand. That's enough. That's enough. Al-Anons are quickly addicted to compliments. Don't laugh. You should never laugh at the Al-Anons. No, you shouldn't. You shouldn't. Our book speaks very kindly of them. It says they're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. Now don't laugh. Don't laugh. It never pays to laugh at Al-Anons. Dave tells me that there are a few alcoholics here in the Atlanta area that are having a little trouble making our program. The Al-Anons, they have our steps, they have our traditions, they've stolen our slogans. Every once in a while I catch one of them reading our books. They've got our whole program. And they can drink, too. It might be just what some of you are looking for. Yeah. No, I love Al-Anon. I go to Al-Anon myself. I go to AA, and I go to Al-Anon with Max, and Max goes to Al-Anon. She goes to AA with me, and she we respect each other's programs. And, we get some of our best customers from Al-Anon, as a matter of fact. Not only that, but we've got them convinced that when they become alcoholics and join AA, they've taken a step up in life. They're the only people in the world that think that being an alcoholic makes you more of a person than if you're not an alcoholic. So anyway, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad that Max goes to Al-Anon, and she looks charming and pleasant and wonderful tonight. It's just hard to imagine that she drove me to drink for years. So yeah. You'd never suspect it. Actually, Max and I have been married. Oh, God, we've been married, the end of this year, 2nd of December, Max and I will have been married for 49 years. You're applauding the program, actually. More than that, we've been emotionally involved with each other to very varying degrees of intensity, but we've been emotionally involved with each other for over 60 years. Wow, is right, by God, yeah. An interesting thing about that is, I'm sad to say, it makes people angry when I say it, but the young people, like these guys up here in the front row, they young people today just don't have what it takes to put together a relationship like Max and I have. They just don't have it. For one thing, you've got to be very, very old. But you never can tell if they hang in there. It's kind of like my friend Angie says. You ought to get Angie to come out here and talk to you sometime. Angie says there's only two rules to becoming an old-timer in AA. Just two rules. Don't drink and don't die. Anyway, I said I was an alcoholic, and but of course I haven't always been an alcoholic. I said I was glad to be here, and I know that Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I think, are very boring when you're not an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic when I came here. In fact, I didn't actually come, and wasn't sent by the judge or anything like that. It was just that coming to AA was the only way I could get a pass to get off the nut ward of the hospital. I had a patient on the nut ward of the hospital that's on the staff up. And that was embarrassing. The reason it was embarrassing is because I was there by mistake. Well, it wasn't funny, actually. It wasn't funny at all. I had a brain tumor, and they completely missed it. That's not funny. You can die from a brain tumor. In fact, that was my plan. I'd die, and you'd all be sorry, by God. But I certainly wasn't one of those dumb alcoholics. I drank. Of course I drank. We live in a drinking society. You have to drink. You can't not drink. Nobody'd ever invite you any place if you didn't drink, you know. So I had to drink, and every once in a while I got in trouble. But it wasn't because I was one of those dumb alcoholics. When I got in trouble or drank too much, it was because I got drunk by mistake. And whatever happened, happened by mistake, because it wasn't what I intended to have happen, and so it happened by mistake. Therefore, it wasn't really all my fault. But I wasn't one of those dumb alcoholics who knew what they were doing and did it anyway. And mine was more like I would, maybe I'd mix my drinks. You should never mix your drinks. You'll have to get in trouble when you mix your drinks. Or drink on an empty stomach. That'll do it. You absorb it too fast. It goes in your bloodstream too fast. You get in trouble. You should never drink on an empty stomach. Bad booze. There's a lot of bad booze out there. That'll do it. But I wasn't one of those dumb alcoholics. And I had to come to AA meetings to get off the network, and I didn't belong here, and it's embarrassing. And the trouble was that Max decided she liked the AA meetings. That's right. In fact, it really screwed up my life. Because once I found out she enjoyed the meetings, then when she'd act smart, then I'd punish her and I wouldn't go to the meeting. And that damn woman, even before Al-Anon ruined her, she'd get in the car and she'd go off to AA meeting by herself. I don't know if you've ever tried sitting at home on a Saturday night and drink while your non-alcoholic wife is off laughing it up in an AA meeting. Boring. So you don't know what she's doing. And so I had to come back to the meetings. And I came to meetings, and alcoholism is a contagious disease. You get it at meetings like this. You do. If you're here tonight, then you're not really, really, really an alcoholic. You want to be real careful what you listen to. Because you don't get alcoholism by what you put in your mouth. You get alcoholism by what you let go in your ears. So if you're not really an alcoholic, you're here tonight, be careful. Keep an open mind. Keep it wide open. So that whatever goes in goes right on through. Because if one of those ideas stops for just a minute, and I say something, you think, oh my God, I did that. You suppose I might be an alcoholic? Boom, just like that, you got it. And the trouble with it is, once you got it, you can't get rid of it. There's no getting rid of it. You can try giving it away to other people to get rid of it, but that doesn't work. It makes it worse. The more you give it away, the more you got it. And so be real careful what you listen to. I wasn't an alcoholic. I came to one meeting too many. And, I turned into a very mild alcoholic. Very mild. Just bad enough to keep coming back. And the trouble is, it's gotten worse and worse ever since. I keep getting to be a worse alcoholic all the time. But you get it at meetings like this. If you don't believe that you get it at meetings like this, try it. Go down to one of the local bars. Say, I'm running a survey. Will all the alcoholics please raise their hands? You won't get the same response down there. You won't get the same response. In fact, they won't even think you're very damn funny. Anyway, I turned into an alcoholic. And I used to drink, and sometimes I drank too much. But I wasn't an alcoholic. Now I'm an alcoholic, and I don't even drink. Well, it's not because I quit. I didn't quit. I found out that quitting business is no good. I did that many times because when I turned into an alcoholic, I thought, gee, I better not drink. In AA, they don't like for you to drink. They don't. They don't tell you that, but you can tell. You can tell. I figured that out early. You can tell. I thought I better not drink. If I stoop this low, I got to be successful at something, so I might as well be successful in AA, so the first thing I got to do is not drink. And yet every time I quit drinking, I quit drinking many, many times, and every time I quit drinking, I ended up drunk. And I thought, geez, this quitting drinking is really hard on my health, And so here I am, now I'm an alcoholic, and I can't drink because I'm in AA, and I can't quit because I get drunk. So what do you do? That's called a dilemma. What it means is that without AA, you're screwed. But then I remembered the stupid stuff you say, that it's the first drink that gets you drunk. That's the dumbest thing I ever heard. I've never, ever gotten drunk on the first drink. And then if you don't drink today, you won't get drunk today. And one drink is too many, and 1,000 is not enough. And all that simplistic, stupid stuff, that this is okay for dummies from Skid Row, but you don't tell a doctor something like that. But I didn't know what else to do, and I thought, well, I won't tell anybody, but I won't drink today and see what happens. Nothing happened. Yeah. So I thought, well, I'll try another day. Nothing happened that day. And It's kind of what I do. Today's a very important day for me. Today's the day I don't drink. Drank many yesterday. Certainly going to drink tomorrow. Don't think I could keep from drinking today if I didn't know I was going to drink tomorrow. So when tomorrow comes, I'll check your time. If it's today, I won't drink today. See? See? Hasn't this been a beautiful day to stay sober? Everybody having a good time?
Yeah.
That's the good news. Most everybody's having a good time. The bad news is, if you're not having a good time, it's your own damn fault. Yeah. That's the way it works. I figured out when I first got sober, I was supposed to figure out why I drank. And, you know, I don't know why I drank. I drank. I used to drink because there were a lot of people around. You all have to drink when people are around. If people come, you have to give them a drink. They'd be insulted if you didn't give them a drink. You go visit them, they'd be insulted if you didn't accept a drink. You have to drink when people are around. Then I remembered I drank when I was alone because I was lonely. I used to drink when it was hot. That's what beer was invented for. Supposed to drink beer when it's hot. I remember going to football games. You always took a bottle along because it might get cold. I drank when it was hot, and I drank when it was cold. I always drink on happy occasions like weddings. That's why they invite you to their wedding, so you can celebrate with them. Nobody would invite you to a wedding if you didn't drink. And then I remembered my own father's funeral. In any funeral, any wake I've ever been to, they always say, Paul, there's some liquor out in the kitchen. Help yourself to a drink. I always drink on sad occasions, drink on happy occasions. Daytime, you used to drink daytime drinks. Nighttime, I drink nightcaps. Sometimes I just drink it just because it's there. I'd be looking in the refrigerator just to see what's in the refrigerator. My refrigerator. I'd say, oh, here's a lonely can of beer. Yeah. What can you do with one beer? You have to drink it. I mean, there's nothing else you can do with one beer. You can't give it to anybody. They say, aren't you going to have one? Oh, no, that's the only one in the house. You know? You have to drink it. I'd go out and buy some because there wasn't any there. You know? Never know when somebody's going to drop by. You know? They always talk about people who drink because it makes them feel so wonderful, make them feel 8 feet tall and feel just real wonderful and happy and all that. Wonderful. And I think Clancy says, you drink, go blah, 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 and boom, and you feel wonderful all over. I didn't have that sense of wonderfulness when I drank. Mine was more like my friend Father Terry. He says he didn't feel wonderful when he drank. He felt like he was going to feel wonderful in about 15 minutes. Mine was more that way. This one isn't going to do it, but the next drink really is. Every drink tasted like one more drink. The next drink is going to do it. And I remember I used to go to church dinner dances. Hate church dinner dances. Hate church dinner dances. A lot of people there. They expect you to talk to them. I don't know how to talk to people at church dinner dances. I don't know how to make chit-chat. And they expect you to dance. But I don't know how to dance. So I used to have a few drinks before I go to church dinner. I have to be very careful not to drink too much. Just a couple of drinks before I go to church dinner dance. Relax me mentally, and I could talk to people. Relax me physically, and I could dance. Boy, I could dance good, too, by God. Today I don't drink, and I don't dance, you know. But it relaxed me mentally, it relaxed me physically. But as time went on, I realized now, in looking back on it, that the two got out of sync. And I wouldn't have even begun to relax mentally yet, and I'd get too relaxed physically. And my tongue and my mouth would act funny. And I would talk slowly and deliberately so nobody would notice it. Or I would reach for something and knock it down, or I would trip when there was nothing. I would find myself lying there, just lying there, looking very serene, but just lying. And my body would say, "Get up, you fool. People will think you're drunk." And my body would say, "What do you mean, get up? We're paralyzed from the ears down." And I'm lying there thinking, isn't that strange that I can't move? I must react peculiarly to this drug, alcohol. I must have an idiosyncrasy to alcohol. I'll have to look that up. I'll have to find somebody to talk to. I never did. Never found anybody to talk to about that. And you can't ask just anybody, because even people who don't know what they're talking about will say some stupid thing like, "Well, if it affects you like that, why don't you just stop drinking it?" Bunny, dumb comments. I wanted something scientific. And in fact, I lie there and mentally be leafing through the pages of Goodman and Gilman's textbook of pharmacology, looking under alcohol poisoning, blood levels, and looking for paralysis from the ears down. I could never find it. Being of scientific bent, it was kind of an interesting scientific problem. And besides, by thinking about it and trying to figure it out, it took my mind off my full bladder. And a very impractical combination. But when I was paralyzed from the ears down, I always had a full bladder. A bladder that absolutely refused to remain full. And the sad part about that is that AA has not been helpful for that. My bladder capacity has not improved with sobriety. And almost 21 years of sobriety, my bladder capacity today is as bad as it was for beer. But I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining at all, because, on the other hand, my aim has improved tremendously. And that's nice. I like that. I like that. And Max likes that. Yeah. Well, it's nice to have your aim back. Because it doesn't do much for your macho image to have poor aim. Especially when, as a kid, you used to be able to write your name in the snow, by God. So anyway. Anyway, I turned into an alcoholic, and I was busy making a list of things in AA, things that you had done that I hadn't done, which eventually, when it got long enough, would prove that indeed you were alcoholic, but obviously I wasn't. And when you agreed with me that I wasn't alcoholic, you'd also ask me what I thought of AA, so I was making another list, the list of things that were wrong with AA, so that you could improve it, because I knew you'd want to know. I happen to be an expert in fault finding, and I knew you'd want my expertise to put it to benefit. Today I realized that nobody's ever asked me for either list, come think of it. I ended up in the nut ward. That's what I did. I had taken a few pills too. I guess I should mention that. But I never became a pill head. No, I didn't. Pill heads are people who take pills to get high or to get loaded, or they like the taste of the pills or something. I know the scientific explanation. They abuse their pills. You ask any doctor. Ask any doctor how their patients got hooked on pills. First place, none of their patients ever got hooked on pills. But pill patients who get hooked on pills, they always do get hooked for the same reason. They abuse the pills. They abuse the pills. Now, I don't even know how to abuse a pill. I know about verbal abuse and wife abuse and child abuse and sexual abuse, but I don't know how you abuse a pill. You throw it down the floor and stamp on it, or throw it against the wall, or talk mean to it, or something like that. No, that's it. I was very gentle with my pills. They were just tiny little pills, anyway, just tiny little pills. In fact, they have had a pill pocket. That's what this little pocket inside the big pocket on the coat is for, is to carry your pills in, and to keep them there. You can't carry your pills just any place. Put them over with your change, you know, and people say, you got change for a quarter? And you say, oh, yeah, here, you like that? And they say, oh, you're carrying Nembutal around the daytime, you know. Well, you switch it over to the other side where your keys are, and you go to get in your car and take your keys out, and a quaalude runs down the street, you know. And it always runs faster than you can, you know. You got to try to get in front of it to stop it. You can't just step on it or you'll abuse it. You feel like a nut chasing a pill down the street. You have to be careful with your pills. I never abused them. I never ever took a pill unless I had the symptom. I had the symptom that only that pill would correct. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. And I would, so every pill I ever took was medically indicated at the time, taken according to directions and prescribed by a doctor. And dispensed by a pharmacist. I went to pharmacy school. And Max is talking this afternoon. Max, now you know she's weird. He told you this afternoon she bought 1,000 Librium and took one a day. Isn't that the weirdest thing you ever heard? I mean, why bother, for God's sake? And they were only the 10 milligram at that, for God's sake. Anyhow, as I said, I ended up in the nut ward. Started going to AA meetings, and I heard a lot of dumb stuff. Really dumb stuff, right? I remember the time a guy stood up, a big, healthy, husky guy. Big, healthy, husky guy. About like these guys. And sitting up there, and he says, If I don't drink today, I'm a success today. And I thought, oh, God, I was ashamed. What kind of an organization is this where they brag about not having a drink for one day, for God's sake? These AA people seem like such fanatics. They even fuss about beer and light wine. Those were the things I drank when I quit drinking, for God's sake. That's the way you think when you're still drinking between meetings. And then there was somebody stood up there, and I think it was a gal. She got up there, told him, and she says, just blurted it right out. She says, I was judging me by my intentions, and the world was judging me by my actions. I was sorry she said that. I was sorry she said that. I will tell you in all humility, I am one of the best intentioned people you have ever met. I will match my intentions with anybody here. I'm a very well-intentioned person. And then when she said that, I set my intentions aside. Because when I got drunk, it was not my intention to get drunk. But I set all my good intentions aside and just looked at my actions. Just looked at my actions. I was a drunken husband, drunken father, drunken citizen. Drunken doctor, for God's sake. It had never been my intention to be a drunken doctor. I think it was very important that right about the same time, short time later, another meeting, some guy stood up at the meeting and just blurted it out for no reason at all. Says, I'd rather be in AA by mistake than out there by mistake. And that expression has affected my life to this day. To think of the cost of practicing our disease, of being out there by mistake. I don't know how people who read the paper and understand what's going on if they don't know about our disease because of all the things, the cost. It's in the papers all the time. It's the most fascinating disease I've ever studied, alcoholism, chemical dependency. It just fascinates me what alcohol does to nice people like us. Not only what it does to us when we drink it, but what it does to us to make us drink it. And what it does to the people that love us that are allergic to it. The only thing more fascinating than the disease is the recovery. I don't know of any disease wherein when people get well, they get weller than they were before they got sick. My background is in internal medicine. I've studied all the diseases of adult men and women. Don't do any surgery, can't stand the sight of blood. Don't do any pediatrics, can't stand kids, for God's sake. Just adults. I've studied all kinds of, but it's the only disease I know we're in when people get well, or weller than they were before they got sick. We get weller than well. I believe it's probably because the recovery is spiritual and there's no end to it. There's no end to what we can. Brings up the question of what is alcoholism. I have my own feelings about what alcoholism is, and I don't talk about it too much because I don't want anybody to argue with me. My mind is made up. Don't confuse me with any facts, you know. But I like to think of it. I do think of alcoholism being an alcoholic being a person who generates a great deal of love, whether they want to or not. They generate a great deal of love. Always. They generate a great deal of love, but they cannot express it. It can't be expressed. So the pressure of love keeps building up and it can't be expressed. What do? They put chemicals in, and that seems to suppress the pressure, like a pressure in a tea kettle. Seems to help, but actually instead of helping, it makes it worse because it complicates the already poor communication problem. So it keeps getting worse and worse. What happens to the people that love us? We can not only express love, we can't receive love, so that the people that love us can't express their love. So the people that love the alcoholic end up with the same sickness. They can't express their love. And the pressure keeps building up. And what happens to it? Comes out as resentment, hostility, anger, violence, all kinds of negative emotions. What do you do about that? Medical profession can't correct that. Legal profession can't correct it. Clergy can't correct it. What happens to the alcoholic? Eventually, they have to come to AA. What do we do with a newcomer in AA? We love the hell out of them. We literally love the hell out of their hellish life. AA is a tremendous example of the tremendous healing power of love. We just love the hell right out of their lives. And what happens? They, in allowing us to love them, they are being loving themselves. Pretty soon they're smiling at somebody else or getting somebody else a cup of coffee or sitting silently and listening in a meeting, just as you're doing now, just to sit in the meeting and be silent and listen to whoever's talking or participating or reading or leading or whatever. That's an act of love. Just like taking the risk of getting up here is an act of love. It's communication both ways. So we literally love each other to hell. We love each other to hell. And it just keeps getting better and better, and there's no end to that. And whatever. I'm just glad to be. Not only not enough chairs, there's not enough air conditioning for all these people. Yeah, so we'll have to cut this short. But I'm glad to be an alcoholic. In fact, I don't really like to travel, but on that good intention thing, I had every intention of being willing to go to Sweden. I don't identify much with the movies, but do you remember the movie Amadeus? Remember Salieri, I think he was, the musician, and he was a good musician. And in the beginning of the movie, he attempted suicide very dramatically, and in the end of the movie, he was giving his blessing to the other inmates in the insane asylum, and he would try to kill himself. He literally went crazy because God would not give him the one little thing he asked for. All he wanted was for God to make him famous. And then he, in turn, was going to give God all the credit. Now, I identified with Salieri. That to me seemed like a reasonable request. Salieri was a good musician, and I was willing to go to Sweden and allow the king to give me the Nobel Prize in Medicine for discovering the cure for cancer and high blood pressure and a common cold, a few things like that. And when he did that, then I was going to tell the whole world that it was God that did it. I was going to make God famous. See? The only thing I asked was that he make me famous first. And by telling me a few little secrets like that, and that would be easy. He could do that. That would be no problem for him. I thought it was a real bargain. But he never bought it. Not only didn't make me famous, he made me anonymous. You know, today I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have no trouble staying sober. To not drink today is an easy thing for me. Don't remind me after the meeting that drinking is my number one problem. I know that. But to not drink is not a problem today. My problem today is to not think. My sponsor says, don't drink, and for God's sake, don't think. If I think I have a problem, I've got a problem. In fact, the nice part about it is if I don't think I have a problem, I don't have a problem. You might think I have a problem, but I don't think I have a problem. I don't have a problem. And I'm the one that decides how big my problems are. If I think it's a big problem, it's a little big problem. If I think it's a little problem, it's a little problem. If I don't have very many little problems, all I have to do is think about it, and it gets bigger. See, my mind is like an energy factory. It puts out tremendous energy, and it goes in like a searchlight or a laser beam. Whatever it shines on, that's the energy goes into that, and it grows. I can take any little old problem and watch it grow. Just think about it. In fact, I don't even have to have a problem to think about. I can take a non-problem. Yeah, well, hell, you can see that's no problem, for God's sake. No, it really isn't. No, I suppose if you thought about it a little while, it could be, you know. And pretty soon I think, well, you know, by God, it is kind of a problem, you know. And pretty soon I'm thinking, you know, by God, it's a good thing I'm looking at this, you know. No, really, everybody else is missing it, and it really is a problem. You know? And God, pretty soon, it's a monstrous problem. And it gets really big, and you look over there, and there it is, and you look over there. And I don't like to have a problem unless I'm going to be obsessed with it. You know, why bother? Why bother with one? And you get one like that, and, you know, people can't even help you with a problem like that. They can't. They tell you dumb things like, well, don't think about it. You know? How are you going to not think about it, for God's sake? And I love my problems. I love to think about them. All my problems today are thinking problems. I don't even have one unless I think I do. And in fact, I'm convinced that it isn't what happens in life that affects me. It's what I think about what happens that affects me. If something happens and I think it's awful, it's awful. And if I think it's no big deal, it's no big deal. And I can largely control my life if I can control my thinking. But controlling my thinking is a little bit of a problem. David, my sponsor, isn't always the big help. He's a wonderful guy. Wonderful guy. Jack Neeson in Los Angeles. Wonderful guy. He works a wonderful program. Terrific role model. But he has this really dumb expression. He says, well, whatever. Now, oddly enough, that well, whatever is beautiful when he applies it to his life. But when he applies it to my life, it seems like the dumbest thing. I mean, back to that good intentions, I always was going to do more with my life than I ever did. I was always going to do more. I'd always planned to accomplish more than I've accomplished. And I would have, too, if it hadn't been for the fact that when I was 4 years old, my father gave up his job as a druggist in Canton, Ohio, and he bought a house drugstore combination in Alliance, Ohio, and I grew up in a crummy little town of Alliance, Ohio. And if it hadn't been for the school I went to, and if it hadn't been for Max, and it hadn't been for all these other things, and I always like to call Jack up and explain to him what it was I had to live with so at least somebody would know why I hadn't done more with my life than I had. Yourself. I guess he did that one day. I guess I called up one day, and he didn't even listen to me. I hardly even got started. And I started telling him about what Max had, some horrendous thing she had done. that I don't quite remember at the moment. And I hardly even got through telling him what she had done. And he just interrupted me and he says, well, why don't you just put it out of your mind a couple of days and see what happens? I said, yeah, a couple of days, I'll forget all about it. It's like any problem. You can't neglect problems. You've got to stay with them. Problems have a fantastically high infant mortality. When you see one, you got to grab it and immediately hang on to it and nurse it and nurture it and care like a delicate plant. You have to water it and fertilize it, a lot of fertilizer. And you stay right with it and talk to it and give energy to it. And you know, you can't neglect problems. I mean, have you ever had a problem that's so delicate, such a work of art that you can't dare leave it long enough to go to a meeting that evening? You ever had one like that? You going to the meeting tonight? Oh, no, I've got to stay home and work on this problem. You leave that problem and go off to one of these dumb meetings, and God, they're liable to keep you there and put the chairs away or clean up or may even drag you off to a restaurant. God, by the time you get home, that problem's liable to be wilted down where you can't even bring it back, you know. You can't neglect problems. You got to stay right there with them and talk to them about it. I don't know how you think, but I think with somebody talking. When I'm thinking, there's somebody talking. Talk. In my head, there's always somebody talk. When I was born, they held me up and bang, I did, and turned on a radio talk show and says, talk. Sometimes it drifts over and picks up another one. There's two of them. Talk. You know. I come to meetings and drink too much regular coffee and go home, go to bed, and I go, talk. My body wants to lie down, go and sleep. My brain says, no, let's lay here and talk about it a while. You know? People think I'm very talkative. It isn't that. It's just I have so many people in my head, and they all want to talk, you know. I shouldn't have even said, my name is Paul and I'm an alcoholic. I should have said, my name is Paul and we're a bunch of alcoholics, you know. As a matter of fact, they're not all alcoholics. There's some of them up there, a lot of them, when they stay sober. But there's one guy, all of them have one phrase, one particular thought, one particular idea that they work on. And there's one guy up there, no matter what the situation, whether it's too hot or too cold, a lot of people, nobody, happy occasion, sad occasion, day or night, whatever, his idea is always the same. Well, I'm going to have a drink. The trouble is, every time he went off and had a drink, we all got drunk, you know. And they've all got their favorite thing to say, and they want to have their say. And there's one of them up there that's afraid. No matter what the situation is, he says, oh, my God, don't do that. You'll screw it up and they'll all laugh at you. I mean, you can't lead a meeting. You can't read at a meeting. You can't speak at a meeting. You can't sponsor anybody. Oh, God, you really screw it up and everybody will laugh at you. He said, don't do that. There's another one up there, softer voice. For a long time, I couldn't even hear his voice. Whoever I listen to, the more their voice gets louder and the other voices drift in the background. But there's one up there that's getting louder all the time now. Says, man, with this program, you can go anywhere, face anybody, do anything, and nobody can hurt you. There's no way anybody can hurt you except to make you take a drink. And with this program, nobody, no how, under no circumstances can make you take a drink. So you can go anywhere and do anything you want. There's all kinds of voices up there, all kinds of personalities. The one up there doesn't particularly care for Max. He's back there. He says things like, did you hear what she just said about you? Or they say things like, are you going to let that woman look at you in that tone of voice? You know. And when I was drinking, he had a very loud voice, you know. But today he's moved in the background, moving further in the background. And there's a voice now towards the front. He says, aren't you lucky? Isn't she terrific? Doesn't she have a great sense of humor? Isn't she attractive? Aren't you happy that she goes to Al-Anon? Aren't you glad that she kept going to AA meetings before you went and she's active on the program? We have a thank you. Thank you. I used to drink and take drugs to shut those voices up so I could sleep at night. I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a sleeping problem. A lot of times, like I'd say, I'd want to lie down and go to sleep, and they'd all want to talk to me. And even when I got to sleep, in the middle of the night, they'd say, hey, wake up, we need to talk to you. You know that situation today where you thought it went so well and they were so happy with how you did? It wasn't like that at all. Yeah. You've got it all screwed up. It's a, you wait till morning, you'll find out. Yeah. And I say, by the way, you did the same dumb thing a few months ago. In fact, you've done that many... In fact, you've done a lot of... In fact, let's just make a list of some of the dumb things you've done. But you don't want to write your fourth, by God, we'll take it right here tonight, you know. And for the rest of the night, we're going to ask you questions that have no answers. And all those people talking. I used to drown them up without drugs, alcohol. And today I find that alcohol and drugs, that doesn't work. And it makes everything worse. And there's all kinds of complications to it. But also, when I drowned those voices out, I drowned out God's voice, because that's how God speaks to me. He speaks to me in the voices in my head. Comes to me with spiritual ideas, spiritual thoughts, loving things to do. He speaks to me in those voices in my head. He speaks to me in the voices in AA. So I never want to ever drown out the voices in my head or the voices in AA. I don't do everything everybody suggests. In either case, AA or in my head, but I have to listen and be, when is it God speaking to me at an AA meeting? Is it the leader? Or is it chapter 5, or the steps, or the traditions? Or is it speaker? Or is it the newcomer? Is it an old-timer? Is it everybody? And same way the voice is in my head. Listen, let him talk. I used to fight with him. Used to get mad. Argue with him. And today... I let him talk. I say, well, thank you for participating. If you'll sit down, we'll call on somebody else. Yeah. It's my job is to place the hold the meetings and provide the coffee and donuts. Yeah. And I'm friendly with those voices up there. I said that they come to me in spiritual ideas and loving thoughts. I'm going to have to force myself to sit down here. But one of the things I've never really... I don't like the word love. It's a four-letter word, has too many meanings, and it's too icky, sticky, gooey, lovey-dovey or something. And it has too many meanings. It has something to do with motels, and something something you fall into, and something you fall out of, and something you make and or don't make. I remember one day... I've been hearing new definitions of love in AA, and that has helped me a lot. I remember one night I called Chuck C. Didn't seem very late to me, and I called him. And I said, what's your definition of love? He says, it's the same thing at 11 o'clock in the morning as it is 11 o'clock at night. And I thought, geez, you crabby old fool. I said, well, what is it? He says, it's action. Bang! And he hung up. The reason I called him is because all the time talking about love, 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 love. And he says, love is for free and for fun, expecting nothing in return. For free and for fun, expecting nothing in return. And all the time talking that. And Don G., I guess he was here 2 years ago. I remember him saying that love was having an active concern for another person's welfare. not only an interest in their welfare, but a willingness to take some action for them to achieve it. To love with action again. And I try to think of ways to show love to Max and to be loving. Because they say if you're more loving to even one person, you are more loving to everybody a little bit. Conversely, if you have a resentment against one person, you have a resentment against everybody a little bit, including yourself. And in fact, just the other day, resentment, somebody said, resentment is the feeling I have when I think somebody else ought to feel guilty. And you know, and the problem with that, as I see it, is that when I'm thinking somebody else ought to feel guilty, that has put me in the victim role. And I was the victim all the time I was drinking. I played the victim role in my life. And AA has allowed me to move into the role of being a hero, play the hero role in my own life story, and out of the victim. And I have to watch it because I love to drift back to victim. But I'd much rather be the hero in my own story. But anyway, I'm trying to think of ways to be loving to Max. And one of the things that I've come up with is that Max loves to wake up to... that's not true. Now, Max absolutely hates to wake up. Max loves to sleep. I don't know. I have no idea where she stores all the sleep she gets. But when she does wake up, she likes to roll over on a left bedside stand. She likes to see a hot cup of coffee. Oh, that's right, you know. Now, she doesn't like hot coffee. And she hates cold hot coffee. She likes hot coffee with 3 ice cubes that haven't quite melted yet. Now that's not asking too much. I mean, because if the ice cubes have melted, then her day starts right off with a problem. Yeah. She'll put the ice cubes in this coffee. And so she likes to see the ice cubes there. So I get up in the morning before she does. I always get up before she does. Everybody gets up before she does. And I go and I take care of the dogs. We have 2 Ala dogs. They said to tell you hello, and they come to all our meetings except when we fly, because you can't have 2 dogs on the same airplane for some reason or other. But otherwise, they go to all our meetings that we drive to. They go to a lot of meetings. They go to more meetings than a lot of people that are trying to stay sober. They have nicer personalities than a lot of people that are trying to stay sober. So I get up and take care of the dogs, and I go and write my letter to God. I do automatic writing. Used to do it with pad and pencil. Then I got a selective typewriter, taught myself to type. Type real fast. Don't type good, but I type real fast. And now I've graduated from a typewriter to a computer. And I type God a letter on my computer. And I'll just do it, sit down and do automatic type. Dear God, here we go again. You've been doing a good job. Let's see what you can do with this one. Have a real good day today. And if you have a good day, I'll probably have a good day. And just write as fast as I can without thinking about what I'm writing. And you'd be amazed at the intuitive answers and ideas and things that come to me out of that typewriter, out of that computer while I'm typing. And just amazing. I delight in doing that. And when I get through, I say, well, I'm going to quit. The commuter says, you want to save this stuff? Yes or no? I say, no, and poof, it's gone. It goes where all 5th steps go. But lately, you know, and I often want to know what, I always wish I could predict the future, because it's a lot easier to know whether you want to accept something or not if you know what it's going to be. These surprises. These surprises are what screw you up. I don't know how to predict the future, except for one day. I can do it for one day at a time. And what I do, I write God a letter, and I say, Dear God, here we go again. You've been doing a good job. Let's see what you can do with this one. In fact, you've been doing such a good job, I'm going to give you this whole day. You can just do anything you want with it. Now, that's a big deal for him. No, it really is, because I used to give them two lists of things. A list of things I wanted them to do in the order in which, for God's sake, do this, and then get the, and don't delay on this one, you know, get that. And it's a list of things to do, and another list of things, for God's sake, don't let this happen, or this happen. And so I kept him very busy. And so I don't give him those lists now. He's got a lot of free time. And he doesn't handle it all that well, actually. And so I tell him, I said, now you take this day, and you have come into my life, whoever you want to come into my life today, and you have them say whatever you want them to say, you have them do whatever you want them to do, you have happen today whatever you want to have happen, and you keep from happening anything you don't want to happen, and I'll know that all day today, whatever anybody says to me or doesn't say to me, or whatever happens or doesn't happen, I'll know that that's your will for me for this day. Now you go and you do that and you have fun. Have a good day. I'll check with you in the morning. And I've never had a bad day that I've done that. Nothing has ever happened that seemed to happen by mistake. Everything seemed to fall in place and seemed to be the way it was supposed to be. And we have a good day with that. And it's a way for me to accept the challenge of the day, because that's what I think acceptance is. Acceptance is, instead of denying reality, in fact, I heard somebody say that, I thought they were real atheistic when they said it, and I think it has something to do with the Quran, but it said, the only God is reality. And I thought, geez, that sounds very atheistic. And then the more I thought of it, the more I realized that God creates reality. So reality is the manifestation of God. They said that, and the Bible tells us that God created all this in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. Now, the way I see it is, they forgot to mention, they implied it and thought everybody understand it, but they didn't literally say it. On the eighth day, he went back to work. And he's been creating more and more ever since. He's been making more stars, more galaxies. They understand this whole thing is expanding outward at the speed of light in all directions. And he's making more people all the time. So God the Father, apparently, talk about a workaholic. He did more of these, more of those, more of them. He's just gone nuts making all this stuff. And he doesn't even know how to handle it all. And he had to have his son come along and help out a little bit. And it creates reality. And when I complain about reality, I'm complaining about his handiwork. When I complain about you, I'm complaining about his handiwork. When I don't like me, I'm complaining about his handiwork. He's worked like an idiot creating all this stuff. And he likes for us to like it, I think. Mine does. My higher power does. In fact, if you don't have a higher power or don't have one you're getting along well with, use mine. Go ahead. I ran him. See, he's got a lot of free time now, and I ran him out rent free. You don't even have to ask me. Just tell him I sent you and let me know if it doesn't work out. Maybe I'll speak to him. Anyway, I finally get finished with my letter to God, and I decide it's time for the queen to wake up. And I decide to go make her coffee. And she doesn't like brewed coffee. She likes any kind of instant coffee, any kind as long as it's you, Ben. And there's a certain set of cups she likes. And she doesn't like milk, hates milk, doesn't like cream, makes it too cold, likes powdered cream, Cremora, likes a lot of that. He's heaping teaspoonful of Cremora, level teaspoonful of Uban, in the cup, and you fill a cup with hot water. Now, you don't boil the hot water. You take the water out of the hot water dispenser. The hot water dispenser is a dispenser, and it dispenses hot water. And it has a faucet on the top and a tank in the bottom. You have to hire a man to come and install it. You have to drill a hole in the stainless steel sink that replaced the perfectly good white porcelain sink that was there. And you have to have a hot water dispenser because it dispenses the water at just the right temperature for putting the 3 ice cubes in it. And And you take this in the, you walk in the darkened bedroom, don't turn the lights on, and you're in your bare feet, so you don't step on her shoes, and don't step on the glossy magazines, they're slippery, and you don't kick the newspapers, it rattles too much, and you go to the bedside stand, and you don't look for a bare spot, you just look for a level spot, you know. And you put the coffee down and you turn around and you walk quietly out of the room. You do not make noise. That's cheating. You don't try to wake her up. You walk out of the room and you hope she wakes up before the ice cubes melt. Now that's the easy part. That's the easy part. The hard part is you can't expect her to appreciate it. But if you expect her to appreciate it, then it's not love, it's barter. You're saying, I'll make you coffee if you appreciate it and like me. And that gets back to what I was told as a kid or a young person, that marriage was a 50-50 proposition. Dumbest thing I was ever told. Marriage is a 50-50 proposition, a balance, and you put in 50-50. That's terrible. I spent my life watching the balance. A lot of times I wanted to put something on the balance and I couldn't, because Max hadn't put anything on for a long time. I put something on, and then I'd sit back and watch. When's she going to put something on? Might be a long time before she put anything on. She finally put some little thing on there. Was that 50%? Didn't look like 50% to me, and I take some of mine off. Love is 100%. 100%. You do 100%. One-sided, completely one-sided. You do it for free and for fun. Expect nothing in return. So I'd make coffee and hope to wake up and not expect her to appreciate it. I have to admit, Max is extremely cooperative. She never appreciates it. So that's the way we do it. And at our house, we've learned to communicate. Better and better and better. My communication, we were saying tonight how this is the day after our 53rd birthday. And it had to do with Bill and Bob communicating, one drunk to another. As I see it, alcoholism is a disease. It's a medical problem. Dr. Bill Silkworth convinced Bill W. of that the last time he was in the hospital. He had a medical problem. He was a sick person trying to get well, not a bad person trying to be good. If Silkworth hadn't convinced Bill W. of that those many years ago, we might not be sitting here tonight. Ebby came from the Oxford group, talked to Bill, told him about his spiritual recovery. Bill had his spiritual experience. He had two items, medical problem and spiritual recovery. Medical problem, a spiritual answer. Bill decided that if he goes around talking to other alcoholics and telling them about the spiritual recovery, maybe they could all stay sober, get something going. As I understand it, he talked to 73 alcoholics, I believe, and none of them got sober, and he got real disappointed. His idea wasn't working. As I understand it, he was talking to Lois, his wife, said his idea wasn't working, him talking to other alcoholics and them saying, someone says it's not a good idea, it doesn't work. I understand that she said something to him, something to the effect that, it is working, stupid, you're sober. And he said, oh. I was amazed when I read that he, in talking to Bill Silkworth just before he left for Akron, he was complaining that none of the other alcoholics he was talking to were staying sober. And Silkworth suggested that instead of talking just about the spiritual experience that he had, talk about the medical problem first. Talk about the medical problem and the spiritual solution. Try that and see if that doesn't work. He says, okay, I'll try it. He ran off to Akron. The first drunk he tried it on, it worked. First drunk he tried it on, it worked. And AA was born. And that other alcoholic happened to be a doctor. And God, in his infinite wisdom, saw to it
That doctor was a specialist in rectal distress.
If that weren't the case, we might not be sitting here tonight. You know? So it's a matter of communication. It's a matter of communicating is love. And I find it interesting to try to take these communications that we learn here home and practice them in our own home. With our own. To listen is to love. To listen is to love. To try to communicate is to love. It's not to succeed. Like seeking, it's the seeking of God that counts, not the finding. And it's the trying to communicate that is an act of love. In either direction, in any way. And my communications today are better with Max, they're better with my higher power, they're better with people in AA, they're better with people outside AA, and they're better with all the people in my head. We got a meeting going on all the time, and it's a comfortable thing most of the time. And so I'm delighted to be a member of AK. I'm just delighted to have this program. I think it's just terrific. I love many lines in the book. There are many lines in the book. I'm fascinated by many of them. One of them it says, our past becomes our most prized possession. That amazes me. In fact, I woke up this morning. I thought, what are you doing in Atlanta, you idiot? And they said, how did you come to Atlanta? And I said, why? Well, because I quit drinking. What the hell? I mean, I quit drinking and then I get invited to Atlanta. It doesn't make any sense. All kinds of wonderful things have happened just because I quit drinking. Because you quit my drinking. You keep me sober, right? I can't stay sober. You can't stay sober, but we can stay sober. You keep me sober. But what I started to say was, I love the line in the book. It says it in two places, one of them in italics. It says, we cease fighting everything and everybody. We cease fighting everything and everybody. That means if I'm fighting anybody or anything, including myself, I'm not working my program right. But what I started to say, and I'm going to say this, and I promise I'm going to sit down. I'm fascinated by the sentence that's on the middle of page 132. Really in the middle. Really. I don't know why I did this, but I counted it. There are six. Check me out if you want. Yeah. In fact, I'll fix you for laughing. I heard the other day that there was a woman who went to AA and she had a tremendous sex problem. And she said something about it and they told her that all her sex problems, all the answers she would need are in the book on page 69. Now, people love to get excited about the fact that it's on page 69. I wouldn't know. I don't understand that. But she went home to look up the answers to her sex problem on page 69, except that in the transition from the meeting to home, she got it mixed up, and she thought it was page 96. And I'm not even going to tell you what's on page 96. You can go home and look it up. But on page 132... in the middle of page 132, with 16 lines above it, 16 lines below it, two extraneous words before it, and two extraneous words after it, right in the middle, it says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. Isn't that interesting? Absolutely insist. The steps are suggested, but we absolutely insist. That's in a textbook on how to recover from a terminal illness. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. So the point is, if you're not enjoying life, you're probably not doing it right. If you're not enjoying your sobriety, you're probably not doing it right. I haven't done it long enough. I think that life is meant to be enjoyed. Sobriety was meant to be enjoyed. This program was meant to be enjoyed. And I think we're duty-bound. I think God enjoys it when we enjoy it. And so I'm delighted, absolutely delighted. I'm not delighted to be an alcoholic. I'm delighted to be an alcoholic, but I'm not proud to be an alcoholic. I'm neither proud nor ashamed of it. Why should I be proud or ashamed of it? I didn't have anything to do with it. You might think, well, yes, you did. You drank too much. I don't know that I'm an alcoholic because I drank too much. I think I may have drank too much because I'm an alcoholic. I understand alcoholics have a tendency to do that. I don't take any credit for being an alcoholic, but I'm mighty proud. Mighty proud. Mighty proud indeed to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's absolutely fantastic. And I thank God for AA, and I thank you for my sobriety. Good night. Thank you.